technology. It's the most a computer's the most versatile tool we've ever made. So it amplifies the ability to improve all these other things in the world. And because of that, I believe it must be open source. And so taking that ethos and trying to identify, where I can contribute to help the Linux desktop become more popular and more usable and accessible to people is the reason behind why we, started System76.
Welcome back to another episode of Nerding Out with Victor. Today, I'm super excited to be joined by Carl Richella, who is the founder of System76. Hey, Carl, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on.
So, the reason why we really our paths crossed was it's about 6 months ago by now, but at the recording back in The Hague at a Ubuntu conference, and we had booths next to each other and we just started chatting really. And I've known you guys for a long time. You guys are kind of the OGs of the Linux desktop world and Linux, well, I guess desktop and laptop world. So I have a lot of respect for what you guys have done over the years. So it's super excited for myself as well to have you guys on and have you on. And maybe for those who are not familiar with System 76, walk me back to the early days of when you started. Like, why was the first, like, back, go walk back to early 2000s, I believe, when you guys started. Like, walk me back to then. Why did you start the company?
Yeah, it's funny. I get asked this question often. Sometimes I think, I don't remember what I had lunch for lunch yesterday, let alone 20 years ago. But a lot of the memories are also still really vivid because it's such a special thing when you're building things. And so it was 2005 when we were founded. So this is our 20th year in business. When we started, Linux, in my view, the Linux desktop in particular, had reached a level where it was of the same quality and similar capabilities of its proprietary competitors. I think Mac was OS X at that time instead of Mac OS. And
yeah,
I don't remember what Windows version we were on. But the point being, Linux was already a fantastic desktop operating system. But the way that you had to consume Linux was get an ISO. At that time, it was CDs that you would burn the ISO to, install it on your hardware, and then find out what works and what doesn't work. Live disks weren't really around at that point. That came a little bit later as well. So you really kind of had to commit and jump in if you really wanted to see what this was about. And I felt that was, a pretty heavy ask of most people. And so, from other OEMs, Linux was on the server, but nobody was shipping Linux hardware really. And the best way to deliver, I think, a great experience is to take the complexity of, downloading this ISO, burning it onto a CD, and then finding out what works and doesn't work, and reducing that to placing an order for the hardware that you'd like, and everything just works.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about that. And if you do have a problem, you have someone to call and talk through whether it's just using Linux, or whether there's some kind of issue with a hotkey or suspend, or you're having a problem with audio.
That's a kind of worm by itself.
Yes, yeah. Audio is almost always something that has to be developed for a piece of hardware. It's because the codecs, or how they're implemented or wired, changes regularly. So it's typical that we have to do that. So a lot of the work was making suspend work reliably, making all the hotkeys work. At that time, we had dial-up modems still. So making dial-up modems work. Things have improved out of the box for Linux in a lot of ways.
Yes,
wireless almost never worked before. Only certain wireless modules worked. Other modules wouldn't work.
The Cisco ones were pretty reliable, but they were very expensive.
Right. Intel was Intel has, in my view, always been quite supportive of Linux and ensuring their chipsets work on Linux. And when they entered the wireless module arena that also eased things quite a bit because they were ensuring that the modules worked on Linux. But before that, we were doing all sorts of kind of crazy things to wrap Windows drivers and enable works and sure it works.
That's a blast from the past. I remember that.
there's a lot of things that we take for granted today that just weren't the case in 2005. And that also means that was the experience for a lot of users when they would install Linux and they'd say, well, this thing doesn't really, and mind you, laptops were coming out at the same time. So before that, it was desktops, and desktops are typically quite a bit easier to support. But laptops have more functionality with their ACPI requirements, with hotkeys, with wireless, and other things that just are less common on desktop. And so users were, I think understandably trying Linux and saying that there were things that just didn't work for them, even though the desktop experience is really nice. It was this hardware enablement part that just didn't smooth out the experience. I said, that's why I started Sim76. And even before that, my own personal ethos was driven by foundational ideas with technology, and that austerity itself is generally a technological problem. Whether we have enough healthy food or clean water or enough energy, these are all technological issues for us to solve. And if they're technological issues, then the best thing that amplifies that is a computer. And what amplifies a computer is it being open source, because that means more people have access to source code and understanding how software works and using that software and building upon it. So my belief in open source goes quite deep to how it can improve humanity itself. Because technology, computer's the most versatile tool we've ever made. So it amplifies the ability to improve all these other things in the world. And because of that, I believe it must be open source. And so taking that ethos and trying to identify where I can contribute to help the Linux desktop become more popular and more usable and accessible to people is the reason behind why we started Sim76.
We'll dive into more recent developments, I guess, in systems of, say, with Pop OS and Cosmic and all those things in a second. But what did you ship the first devices? What did they ship with? Was that Ubuntu, Debian? What did they actually ship with? Or any all of the above?
The first version was Ubuntu Breezy Badger 5.10.
Right.
So it was October 2005. I do like their numbering because I can even remember the month that it came out in 2005 and the year it came out. So I think the first release was 5.04, and that was Warty Warthog, and then Breezy Badger was the second release, and that was the Linux distribution that we shipped with. So it was very early days for Ubuntu, and it was somewhat of an odd decision to make at the time. I like to say it was intuition. Maybe it was luck. It was much more likely luck. But I had been running RHEL and SUSE, and I really liked this small distribution called Yoper and what they were working on at the time. It's not around anymore, but I thought it was a cool distro. And the first time I tried Ubuntu, I installed it from my burned disk, and I couldn't SU to root. what's up with this? And I spent like 5 minutes on it, and I was like, okay, I'm moving on. and then like a month or two later, there was this Ubuntu guide that came out, and it was maybe 40 or 50 pages. And I printed it out, and I put it in a binder. These all feel really like archaic things to do, but and then I reinstalled it and I walked through it step by step. I started understanding the design decisions behind it, why Ubuntu had built it the way that they did, and then it all kind of clicked that I think they're onto something here, and that eventually led to Ubuntu being the distro of choice. We specifically decided not to have multiple distributions available, because I think the decision to buy a Linux computer in and of itself, for a lot of people that are using Windows, I mean, remember, we're not here Yes, we care very much about supporting the Linux community and the users of Linux. But what we're really here for is to expand that Linux market to all the people that this is brand new to. So right. We thought them coming to a website and then, okay, now I need to pick which computer makes sense for me. Okay, let's try to make that as easy as possible. Then, okay, now I have to choose which Linux distribution, and I don't know the differences or what all these things mean.
Yeah.
So I think it was important to decide and use, you know, one Linux distribution and, you know, make that a great experience. It also means our focus could be very tightly aligned with fixing any issues with hardware with one distribution and trying to support them. Like I think quality of the product would have been lower. So for all those reasons, we chose Ubuntu and went with one distribution that we would ship.
And I think it was roughly around that time, both Dell and, well, back then IBM launched. They had, both of them had laptops, I believe, at least, with Ubuntu as well. It was roughly that. Maybe it was a few years later when they shipped that, right? It was there was a wave, and then they killed it, and then it came back, and they killed it, right?
Yeah. I remember this distinctly because I think it was a couple of years after we started, maybe even three years. It was a while after we started, and Dell threw up this website that said, what do people want? And they were kind of crowdsourcing what the people, you know, what their potential customers wanted. And the top one was Linux on laptops or Linux on their products. And to their credit, they responded to that. Interestingly, Michael Dell actually called me.
Oh, really?
Yes. So that was a treat because I was always a fan of Michael and his work and what he had done with his company and what he had built. And so they were trying to navigate, this is what our users are, this is what people are saying that they want. System 76 is doing this, let's talk to them. And so I got to talk to Michael. It's funny, I was on I put in my own VoIP phone system. I don't know what it was called. Asterix.
Oh, yes.
So I had done PBX programming before. And so I put Asterix in, and that's what it was doing, like our support routing and automated attendance and all those kind of things. But it's all over the internet. And my internet, while I was on the phone with Michael Dell, my internet starts like crapping out. Oh, man. About the first thing is chopping up. And he says, well, I'll just call you back. And calls me back, and it was smooth after that. But that was a little bit embarrassing. But
that's funny.
We had a good conversation. I told him, the first 30 days, because I think our goal is Linux desktop success. And so to my mind, Dell entering the market meant that would help.
Right.
With that success, it would legitimize Linux on the desktop because a tier one OEM is doing it. Yeah. I didn't think of it as in some kind of competitive way. I just answered all questions that he had honestly and openly. And we talked about it because I wanted to help if I could any way that meant Linux could be more successful.
And I think they shipped with Red Hat, I believe.
They shipped with Ubuntu.
Did they?
They were shipping Red Hat on servers and servers, but on the laptop, Ubuntu had at that point it established itself in the mindshare of the Linux community that was really the distribution to target. We were again lucky or had some intuition, whichever it was when we started. But by the time Dell was looking at it, that was a pretty clear choice.
Interesting. Yeah. So they kind of, I'm not sure like if they are still shipping with that as an option, because back then it was like the Windows tax was a big topic of discussion in the in the Linux world, right?
I don't know. It's I know it was the Sputnik project, and I'm pretty sure it's still going on, but it's interesting you say that because it's been a while since I've heard about it or thought about it. So I'm not sure.
I think the Lenovo X1s you can get a special version of with Ubuntu, but not like the wide range of all of the versions, which is kind of, I've had some conversation with people at Canonical about that as well, but it usually comes down to the whole like driver issue that you're describing, right? Like making sure that it works across all of them, right? And that's not a trivial part, a trivial thing to get to. All right, so you launched that, and then you decided to launch on Ubuntu. You launched your first few devices, and at that point in time, how much was custom, like with regards to your devices or the System 76 devices, and how much was just a branded OEM device? How did you start from there?
Yeah, so on the software side, there weren't we were taking vanilla Ubuntu and just doing hardware enablement,
right?
So identifying, and one of the interesting things about QA and QC is that your checklist for quality only grows, never becomes shorter. So we had a checklist that we go through and identify all the holes in support, and then we do the work on the hardware enablement.
Ended up writing drivers or fixing drivers upstream in the kernel, or how do you do the enablement on that side?
Right. Some things like a touchpad might not have been working correctly, and so we would push patches, upstream, and we would deliver a DKMS package in the interim until the upstream packages were released, and then went through the entire flow of Ubuntu's process and out to customers. So we have this gap in time between when support is coming directly from System 76 and then when it comes from the kernel.
Right. Okay. Interesting. And then you evolve from there to do a lot more customizations to these days. Like, how much is entirely custom today, and how much is bought? Like, and I guess how many components are you actually doing yourself today? I guess you're not doing your CPUs, obviously. You're not doing your GPUs, but in terms of how much is custom today? Like, how far have you gone in the manufacturing journey of that?
Right. In 2018, we built a factory in Denver. And that was to start taking more control over the design of the products and start taking more control of how they're delivered and how we can iterate on improvements. Coming from largely a software background, we think of things as continuous integration and continuous improvements. And when we're working with hardware, particularly the case vendors, they're kind of designed in a way that they're supposed to fit lots of different needs, but that doesn't mean they fit the needs when you're talking to your customers about what they want.
Right.
So that was our first foray into manufacturing ourselves instead of using external manufacturing, and our own design as well. We started with desktop because it's just an easier form factor. And long term, the objective is we work with ODMs for laptop manufacturing and our mini PC manufacturing.
Yeah.
But the long term objective is to take that engineering and design expertise that we've grown and start moving that into laptop products and other products as well. And our launch keyboard was like an interim project to start getting there, because we wanted to learn precision milling, and we wanted to learn high-speed electrical design and the things that went into that. That's why our keyboard has a high-speed USB hub in it, because it's rather complex to do, but also a really nice feature for customers. And we get to learn the institutional knowledge of how to achieve that in delivering a product, plus the precision milling around USB-C ports, USB-A ports, and fitting that all together. So all of it's been a journey to kind of grow our expertise as we bring more and more in-house.
How ambitious can you be there? Because there are obviously, you can't fabricate a lot of chips, right? That's more or less impossible to do outside of a few manufacturers in like Taiwan and China, right?
It's not efficient either.
No. Right. Yeah. Your volume is not quite up there with Intel's volume or with the volume of these like Broadcom or all these guys, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, Nvidia. It doesn't make sense for Nvidia or for Dell or HP for a lot of these. That's kind of changing somewhat. You see it in the cloud. Amazon and Google making specialized chips.
The hyperscalers are doing a lot of customization stuff, right? So yes.
I think that says a lot about their margins.
Certainly,
possibly more than other things, and how heavy the competition is.
Yeah.
But I mean, sharing supply chains, I think, really important for efficiency and competitive and keeping prices competitive for customers. So yeah. I think there's decisions to be made. I would love to have an SMT line to manufacture motherboards. I think that would be awesome.
Yeah.
But is it efficient? Does it make sense? There are, should we reproduce that? Or I think a lot of the secret sauce is how you take those components and integrate them into a final product, more so than the individual components themselves in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the landscape in the last 12 months when it comes to supply chain and supply chain security as well for hardware and chips, like that is a debate we've seen a lot more in recent time. And being able to, at the very least, control the firmware of a lot of these chips is a massive, and making sure that that's done in a friendly environment, right? Because look at the security landscape, for instance, around like Hikvision is one of those like CCTV camera companies, right? They're banned by the UK government, for instance, and the US government, I think, because they don't really trust it, right? Or Huawei, right? So like that bringing back, not necessarily bringing back manufacturing, but like bringing back assembly and understanding of what goes in there, I think is something happening more and more. Is that reflecting what you're seeing as well?
I think that's a great point. When you're building technology, having an understanding of that technology from the firmware level all the way up, I think is really valuable. Not only for the experience you can provide for your customers and the support, but also the security for your customers, in that when they have a question about something very technical at a lower level, that you actually have either the source code or the ability to respond to that in a way that is builds confidence with those customers. It's complex. Yeah. And goes right to your point about supply chain and supply chain challenges, because even with firmware, when Intel introduced BootGuard, that became very complex, because there's a command you run at the end of firmware provisioning in the manufacturing facility that burns the fuses, and that means you can't rewrite the firmware, we can't hack on the firmware, and so we have to have special SKUs just to be able to do things we're doing with open firmware. Fortunately, in a lot of places, we have the scale and relationships that we can do that, but it's not in all places. And so that's also a growing project where we can expand our use of open firmware to more and more products that we're building.
Yeah, and that was, you set me up for a great segue here, because like the reason why we at Screenly reached out to you guys and wanted to work with you guys, because we wanted to have a partner we can work with that can actually understand all the layers, right? And for me, the reason why this really became a more urgent priority was in the rise of like Logifail and Pixifail, that really highlighted the importance of understanding what actually goes into the blobs that sits on your device. And I work with ODMs, OEMs in China, and very few of them are technical. They are box pushers, right? They were just like, yes, here's a box. If you ask them anything about it, they will not be able to tell you. Like, there are obviously more savvy ones that will do that, but a lot of them, they are within reach of anybody who's not doing like insane MOQs will not be able to do that, right? So for me, just with our new Screenly Player Max Mark II, which is powered by System 76, that's the one thing that I'm super excited about, being able to have a partner that really understands all the way layered down. So like from the BIOS all the way up, how things work. So open firmware, open hardware, those are two things that really resonate well with me in the ethos of there. Yeah. So the play we have, we are not quite on Core Boot in this iteration, but the goal is the next version of this Max Player will have Core Boot, which I am super excited about having. That's kind of where we started. But talk to me a bit more about your vision on open firmware, because we can dive into open hardware in a second, but open firmware, let's start with that, because I think that's something that we've only in the last year or two started seeing more and more conversations around.
Right. Well, this kind of goes all the way back to 2005, because I remember distinctly sitting in my basement at this table with a laptop, and just in awe of how well Linux is working on this laptop and booting in. But then you boot in the BIOS, and I remember thinking, here's the BIOS, and that's the last bit that I don't know if we're ever going to get to cross that threshold. But sure enough, years later, one of the problems with jumping into open firmware is that I wanted to stay consistent with being able to offer open firmware. So when we're going from one Intel chipset to the next Intel chipset, what appeared to happen to me within the Kubernetes community was that it would be 3-6 months, maybe longer, before that new hardware was supported. Mm-hmm. And that won't work as an OEM, because you need to be much more rapid with your releases, and if we're competing with Windows, we don't want to be on old generations. Plus, the hardware supply chain doesn't flow that way either. It's actually hard to buy old CPUs that are integrated more. So Intel contacted us once, said we'd like to work with you on open firmware. They had three engineers come out, and we sat in a room. It was like blizzarding outside, and like 8 hours go by. They have a really, really long, I love this story because it's so funny to me. It's this like super long presentation. We're going through the slide deck and everything, and they're talking, we're chatting. And then the next morning, they came in and said, "So will you work with us on this?" And he just said, "Well, yeah, you had us at open source." Like, that was all, this is exactly what we want to do and what we'll be able to do. We wanted 0-day open firmware. We've had some challenges recently that we haven't had in the past with that. Like Intel's latest HX chipset platform was such a dramatic change, and because of supply chain things where we were moving supply from China to Taiwan, all the timing just became complex. And so now we have some products that are shipping with closed firmware while we port the open firmware because the timing just didn't work out. But we're dedicated to open firmware and ensuring we can continue that on products.
And today in the device you're selling, how many proprietary blobs are in there still? Like are most open firmware, or like I would imagine GPU drivers and whatnot may not be, but like how much of the blobs are actually closed?
That's a great question. I don't have an exact answer because a lot of the functionality for firmware, a lot of the stuff that you actually feel is in the embedded controller. So how rapidly your laptop charges, your CPU wattage is set to, what's it set to when you unplug, and for more efficiency. Same with GPU boosts and what is that set out, and how much the CPU and GPU can share. All those things, your hotkeys, your backlight, all that comes from the embedded controller. I feel like that's actually one of the most important parts to be open. The BIOS or the firmware itself outside of it is really doing hardware initialization to bring up the memory and CPU and everything else. I know that there's a FSP component that comes from Intel that's integrated into the core boot, but exactly how many like blobs and how much exposure there is in the FSP, I'm not entirely sure. I know it's a long leap from that first laptop in 2005 that I thought would never get to open firmware. So I take the approach we work within the confines that we have, and we chip away over time.
Yeah.
So we're not going to get, I mean, my dream is to completely liberate the computer. But that's a huge ask. But I'm also here. I have the endurance. I'm here over time to just chip away at it.
Yeah. How you started by yourself tinkering in your basement. How big is System 76 today in terms of headcount? And
50 employees.
Okay. So that's what's the breakdown between engineering, support, sales, whatever other roles that you may, and manufacturing as well, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's one of the the cool things of this, like a 50-person company, we do everything from firmware development to deciding what aluminum alloy to use for a part.
Yeah.
And so the expertise between all of those, how paint adheres to metal, and how and how to write a desktop environment with auto tiling and session management and audio and Bluetooth, all those other things, is kind of, it's all condensed into this 50-person company. So
that's impressive.
I think these are all rough numbers.
Yeah.
engineering is about 10. Design is 2, and marketing is like 4, and sales is like 4, and manufacturing is like 10, and operations is some, filled in within that group. So, it's everything. We have a care department. It's a 5-team department. So, it's care, marketing, sales, manufacturing. There's the production team, which does production, is taking all the metal in and producing a product that the build team then completes. So the build team takes that that chassis and then builds it to order for the customer, installing motherboard, memory, CPU, and so forth. And then operations is the stuff with HR and healthcare and our systems for imaging and how those are working and how we take orders and how an order that we take ends up in the ERP and the accounting and all the all that fun stuff that's part of operating a company.
And they're all based in Colorado. Everybody's on site, or how's your company structured?
I think it's about 35 or so are in Denver, 35 to 40. And we have about 10 remote folks from Germany and Poland to California and Tennessee. And so quite a few folks that are also remote.
Interesting. Oh, yeah, cool. It gives a bit of insight into how you guys are working. And what I'm really curious about, because I have this vision for at least for the Screenly players for the long run, I really want to embrace open hardware and open like firmware, right? For me that comes in part from a philosophical perspective, but perhaps more importantly from a commercial side of it, if it's not open, I can't trust it. So it more comes back from a security perspective, right? Like then it can be audited. Not necessarily that it will be audited, but at least it can be audited. And I think that's an important distinction. So what's your pipe dream there? Like, is there a world where the future generations of System 76 devices are fully open hardware, open firmware, open source through and through? Is that the pipe dream, or is that a bit too ambitious?
No, it is. I think you have to start with what your long-term and your most ambitious goal is. So if we think about hardware, everything that System 76 does is open source. Mm-hmm. So our all hardware design, all electrical design, all firmware and software, everything we do is open source. So when we started, it was, just drivers and hardware enablement. And now that's driven into like the electrical design for the large keyboard. If you want to understand how high-speed routing can be done on a PCB, everyone in the world has a great example of how to do it well and can take that and learn from it and adapt it. Interesting thing about that is electrons really don't like sharp corners. and when you're doing something as high-speed as that, some people were looking at our traces and saying, oh, they're just not pretty. But, that's actually, there's something more to learn from that. When you're looking at another keyboard PCB, it's because they're not doing high speed.
Right.
So over time, we've been able to introduce more things that are open source. And I don't see a necessary or requirement to limit ourselves in that. There are practical things that just are the case, and RISC CPUs are extremely exciting, but I don't see us, but we're not at the size where we're going to be designing and and integrating RISC CPUs quite yet. We would use a partner for that.
Yeah.
The thing about RISC CPUs is, although the instruction set and things are all open source, there's a lot of proprietary things that slip in for competitive reasons, even within that ecosystem. So
yeah.
So I think we just chip away, and day after day and year after year, we do more and more that's open source, and over the long haul, I mean, I think every day we can look at something and say, we build something that's more open than it was before. Mm-hmm. And if we can say that again next year, where it's more open than it was before, then we've made progress.
Yeah, I mean, the ability to do these things are required. I mean, they require a lot of skill. Like, I had Eben Upton on a while back, and he was talking about, I was asking him kind of a similar question about the Pi, about being able to do RISC-V Pi, and he's basically like, even with their volumes, like, it's very difficult, right? And obviously they are doing larger volumes, right, than any PC manufacturer would do. Well, not any, but most boutique manufacturers would do, right? Mm-hmm. So I think his biggest problem was around the GPUs, if I'm not mistaken. Like, doing an open source GPU, like, would be almost impossible, right? Even though, right, like, that would be the dream.
Yeah, and we should dream for a more open future, but we work within the the world that we live today, and we just chip away at it. I don't know what I'm going to achieve in my lifetime, but I know it'll be more open by the end. Right. The important part is that it sticks.
Yeah,
things go backwards too, but for it to stick, I think that means it has to have utility beyond just the fact that it's open. And I think open in general often means it has more utility, but it means taking a very liberal perspective of what open source means. Sometimes there's complaints about taking open source software and someone else using it to do something. Some ideas come out of that, like NIH, like not in-house, or ideas like upstream first, or things like that. I think generally to make open source more useful and sticky and have a brighter future, we have to take a very liberal view that is the reason that we're doing this, is for people to take it. And even if they're adapting it, as long as it's, all boats are rising in the same way, thanks to the way the GPL is structured. And so their changes are also GPL, means that it's good for open source, even if it feels like I made this thing and now it's being changed and used over here. We should encourage it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was going to ask you about Chrome OS, right? Because I think Google has probably done more for Linux open source than most other, in the sense of, like, Chrome OS actually, in terms of deployment fleets, right? Because Chrome OS is, if you measure it by desktop, like, it's probably by far the biggest Linux distribution, right? And much to your point about pragmatism, that by itself has helped with core boot, has helped with probably a lot of driver issues. Like, how do you see that symbiosis? Like, is that something that you've seen on your end in terms of, like, has the help the tide rise, or how have you seen that kind of changing the landscape?
Yeah, I don't have like direct evidence, but I think you must be right that with Chromebooks running essentially a Linux kernel, that means the upstream ODMs are thinking more about making sure Linux works, gaining experience in Linux and contributing to the kernel. So that just logically follows that path. I don't know if Chrome OS is a Linux distribution.
Well, you could argue that it is, you could argue that it isn't, right? It depends on how pragmatic you are about and purist you are about the argument, I guess.
I think it's almost like what I'm thinking about with the liberal view that you should be able to build other things with the software we build. That's what makes it valuable. That's what Chrome has utilized. Mm. But is that what Chrome OS is? Can we take Chrome OS and build Linux distributions, or do we not do that because we feel it's limiting by its own nature?
I don't know if you can build your own Chrome OS. I'm not sure. I don't know how much is open source. Actually, that's a very good question. I actually don't know.
I mean, Android is the same thing. I was thinking about this on my drive's like an hour and a half from work to my house, and so I get lots of time to think about stuff. And driving thinking time is always good. But I was thinking about this with Android. Like, we think about, I remember when Mark Shuttleworth, the first Ubuntu bug was Windows has a majority of market share.
Right.
That was bug number one. And I remember when he closed it because Android became the most popular operating system, and it's a Linux operating system. And so that bug was no longer the case. And technically it wasn't. It's true that Windows wasn't. But does that mean that Linux was? Because especially with the case of Android, where its functionality is kind of nerfed intentionally without these other services, you certainly do things with it, but it's built in a way that doesn't make it as, it can't be as useful. The app ecosystem isn't by no means open in a way that you can build a product off of it and build your own Android thing.
You could argue that it is because there are alternative app stores, but then are they really but they're equally, I don't know. Samsung got their own, right?
Yeah. And it's not really to knock Google or their approach. It's just that when I think about a Linux distribution and I think about Arch or Ubuntu or Debian or all of these, they're very easy to build things with and on, and I think that's what makes them powerful. If you're building something with Android, you're locked into a different ecosystem that isn't as open. So I guess that's the same thing. I take a very, very liberal view about what open source means.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think of it like there's the GPL in license and there's the GPL in spirit.
Right.
And when I think about the GPL in spirit, whatever the intention, I think what Solomon's intentions really were, I think about it in spirit, it's more like Debian and less like Android. For what it's worth, that's how it feels to me.
Right. So it sounds like that's a principle you really take it to heart in terms of philosophy, in terms of operating the company as well.
Yeah. It's we do everything that's open source first. There's always these little business logic things that just don't make sense being out in the open. But even a lot of those, unless there's a really good reason, they're just in our repo and other people can look at them and see them.
If we go down the path, let's assume for a second that open hardware really thrives and everything is open and it's fully open source, so anybody can manufacture a System 76 device, right? How do you see that world, right? Where if you have complete open specs for everything and anybody can go and say, build me this in China, how do you see, do you have a moral objection against that, or from both a commercial standpoint and from a, I guess, quality control standpoint as well? How do you see that? Extrapolate further, where it's fully open source, here are my PCB files and schematics, whatever it is, send them off to China and build myself a System 76 laptop, right?
Yeah.
How do you see that philosophically and I guess as a business owner as well?
I think that's the point. So we did this launch keyboard. We have fully open schematics and anyone can take those schematics and build a PCB. And I don't know that anyone has done that. I think maybe what we've done is maybe a little crazy because the features that we built into it, but it's entirely open. And the point is to enable people to do that. It would be no different for a laptop. If And we've done quite a bit of work on laptop motherboards as well. Mm-hmm. But those are more complex in certain areas. There's the licensing makes it very hard to do an open PCB.
Yeah.
So we've looked at ways to build a laptop PCB without violating upstream licenses, but make it as open as possible. So there are complications there. But to your question, let's say we release an open source motherboard, and we do want to do this. And we want to build a modular open source motherboard that whereby you can attach different kind of I/O to the motherboard to build mm-hmm. any product that you want. Basically what we're doing with Cosmic, but do it in hardware. We want right. to do that as well. So, and then we start having that manufactured. And then it has a utility that other people can more efficiently, just because of just the matter of being able to take something that's built and build upon it instead of reinventing that wheel for every laptop. Well, that means our efficiencies grow. Mm-hmm. That means, would it make sense for them to go to another PCB manufacturer? Perhaps we can just do larger MOQs and larger MOQs. And then, our numbers are getting bigger together. We're building different products. We're adding value at different levels. Maybe somebody's mm-hmm. doing a Windows laptop with it. We're doing a Linux laptop with it. Or maybe they're building an entirely different type of device. Maybe they're doing screens but now this ecosystem has grown where we have open hardware that different people can take individual components of that hardware and build products, and now we can scale that up, and now we start getting to the scale where maybe we can do ARM CPU design because we're doing this much. Maybe we can do an ARM board and we can do an ARM CPU design because we're doing this much volume now. Maybe we can start working on RISC because now we have the volume that we can make the chip that could go on the board. All these small players together could achieve more through this openness. And even if big players would adopt a platform like that, it just means more scale for everyone and more ideas and more improvements. And I think it's not different than software in that. There's much more capital involved, but it has the same potential to lift all boats because we can share in platforms.
Yeah. So you're not worried about an OEM in China basically taking the schematics, undercut you because they do a higher MOQs?
No.
Okay. Yeah, because that would be like a... If somebody can compete with your product at a lower price, that would obviously be a bad business risk, right?
I don't know. I don't know that is. You could always be undercut, but I think when we think about products and we think about brands, the right way to protect what your brand is through copyright. Mm-hmm. And trademarks. And I think these are important because a trademark or a copyright isn't about not making something available to people. It's about the reputation of the person that's making something.
Hmm.
So we preserve our reputation through our System 76 and that logo and that brand.
Right.
What you can expect when you get a System 76 product versus another company is what defines who we are.
Right.
And so even if the guts are the same because we are sharing in this platform or we've open sourced this platform, that doesn't mean that the product is the same, the software or the firmware on top of it is the same, or the customer support experience when we're holding our customer's hand through a process to build for a project. All of those things are what make us who we are. The hardware and the software, I think, is a one component of, an important component of it, but not a full design or holistic.
So you want to see that commoditized and then kind of like the brand becomes kind of like, it ties it all together, really, as an experience.
And in many ways, I think you see when something has utility and mm-hmm. other people can gain utility from, just remembered this. It's funny. It's an interesting conversation because someone tried to sell us our open firmware. They sent us emails saying, "Hey, I can make open firmware for you, and you know, here it is." It was like a small company outfit. And we're like, wait a sec, that's our firmware. We really made that. So somebody's out there trying to sell other people our open firmware.
Right.
That's perfectly fine. I don't care. I don't care at all. It's okay that people, I think it's fine to sell open source software too. It's much more important that it's open source. But right. But yeah, this is part of, it takes a lot of bravery to give things away. It takes a lot of generosity to give things away, but we're not going to make the impact on the world that we can if we're not very liberal with the way that we approach this. And we can't be angry that other people are using our embedded firmware. That's the whole point, you know.
Yeah,
brand it, you know, go forth and make. We're all part. I appreciate people that just make stuff,
right?
Even if it's on top of other, you know, other people's stuff. That's great. Add value to the world.
Yeah. Fair enough. No, I mean, it's genuinely like obviously a solid approach. It takes a lot of bravery, like you said, because you can easily be attacked from angles that you couldn't otherwise be attacked, I guess, in sense of like that. But
it's true. Yeah.
All right. Let's take a look into your other portfolio. So we kind of alluded to, PopOS, is that how you pronounce it? PopOS or how?
It is.
Yeah. Why? Like, why you started with Ubuntu? Now you're like, let's make our own OS or fork our own OS, I guess.
Yeah. So it started. We had been shipping. I'm trying to remember the years now. I think it was 20. Been shipping Ubuntu from 2005 to 2016. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Ubuntu was building their Unity desktop. They're from scratch desktop. So before then, they were building a new UX that they felt would be better for their users. And they were building it, you know, using GNOME technologies. And there were some challenges with that because it was hard to package Unity for other distributions because they had to patch all these GNOME libraries. And so it would conflict with running just vanilla GNOME on other desktops. So Unity really, you know, was stuck in the or stayed in the Ubuntu distribution and ecosystem. But the project to build the Unity DE, its own desktop environment, eventually, you know, they started with mobile. They really were, and I completely understand why, because mobile was kind of taking over. I'm sure we'll probably get into Cosmic, but we took a different approach with Cosmic. Some things I had the opportunity to learn from other folks. And this is, I think, one of those.
Right.
So, I think being a student of, is always a student is really important. So, so when Canonical decided to no longer develop the DE and go back to GNOME, it was a shift that was an opportunity because there was a window opening where our customer is going to move to something different, one way or another. So. We had, over the years, built up this understanding and knowledge of our customers and gaps that they had with their experience with Ubuntu and with GNOME. And so we decided that was the right time to build PopOS and take our understanding of what those gaps were and fill them in.
Interesting.
Some were really simple, especially at the beginning. One, we wanted to establish a brand and an identity and a visual look. And so, you know, there was a lot of work with that, but there were also a lot of small things. One was at our, well, maybe they're not small. Our customers really wanted full disk encryption out of the box.
Yes.
To do TPM full backed? Disk. I'm sorry?
TPM backed?
We don't do TPM backed for a reason.
Okay.
We don't, because you can't move the drive. And I think that that's an important characteristic, being able to move the drive. And so we don't do it with TPM. We use, I think it's Lux. LUKS. Mm-hmm. But to do that as an OEM, if you want to shift full disk encryption, you can't encrypt the disk in your install and in your image that you use to duplicate onto other products, because then you have the key. So we built a new installer for PopOS as well, whereby the installation is done during the installation, during the first time setup. But it's so fast, customers don't even recognize that that's what's happening. It's right. actually doing an install and encrypting the drive at their, you know, at their first setup. So that was one thing. Smaller things are like do not disturb. Our, you know, notifications were kept noisy and bothersome, and so we added an extension for that, and little things that we'd shave off over time. And then I think it was 2004 is when we added tiling, auto tiling, to PopOS. So the core answer is that we were able to deliver solutions to our that our customers needed that upstream wasn't in agreement with.
But PopOS is a fork of Ubuntu.
I don't know.
How would you position it?
It uses Ubuntu's repositories.
Ah, okay.
So the GNOME experience in PopOS is completely different than the GNOME experience in Ubuntu.
Right.
So it's lots of forks, okay, I guess, really.
Yeah, like we have this tree of forks now. So Ubuntu started off forking Debian, which started.
Yeah. So it's built on Ubuntu. So when you're using POP 2404, 2204, but soon to be 2404, using the same binaries, there are differences in what we deliver because of hardware enablement. We ship a newer kernel, newer Mesa, newer NVIDIA drivers, things like that. That's just the nature of being an OEM and needing to support hardware a little bit sooner than happens in Ubuntu. But the whole purpose, like auto tiling is a great example of this. Our tech support team, we're a small company, and I'm not very far from the tech support team, and they're getting calls constantly, like second, third release of PopOS. How do I install i3 on PopOS? Or how do I install and set up Sway on PopOS? It was mostly i3 at that time. And all of our developers were using i3. Mm. Even though they're building PopOS and they're working on an extension that we're delivering to customers, they were using i3. And then I went to a Google Summit or Open Firmware Summit at the Google campus in Mountain View. And everyone that I was talking to was using i3. And it was obvious. We're not delivering what our customers want out of the box.
Yeah.
They're calling us and they're telling us. So what PopOS enabled us to do was to act on that need. I think different communities have different, and different customer bases have different needs, and that we should embrace that rather than this, one operating system to rule them all. I think distributions are fantastic. You should have lots of different distributions. Because you can solve different problems for different people, and we don't all need to eat the same cornflakes. We can have different things. It's good. We had certain problems that, like the GNOME community, didn't feel like was a general computing issue, perhaps, in auto tiling, and so we wanted to develop. So we built an extension in GNOME to do that, and so that that further differentiated PopOS from what from what it was before, and all with the intent just delivering to our customers the things that they were telling us they needed.
And that eventually led to Cosmic.
It did. It's a great segue. So that is what led to Cosmic. And there was a resistance to some of the changes that we wanted to make to build the product for our customers. And so we decided that probably the best route for us long term would be to go ahead and build our own desktop environment. We looked at a lot of different
famous last words.
We don't lack ambition, that's for sure. So we looked at different routes of doing so. We could continue with extensions to GNOME, but we would never really be able to deliver the product we would want to, and you're always kind of adapting it to what's happening, what's changing upstream, and so you're spending a lot of time just staying at par instead of going beyond with new features. So we started working on when we decided on that path, we started investing in it, and bringing in the engineering team for the different components and parts that would be necessary. But we wanted to take a very different approach. And our approach is that Cosmic is going to be the flagship desktop for PopOS. But our experience with wanting to build a product using a Linux desktop environment was that it was very, very difficult to do, not just because of sometimes resistance from upstream, but also because of how they're architected. So Cosmic means, it stands for Computer Operating System Main Interface Components.
Nice.
And that's precisely what it is. Everything is modular, everything is composable. So with the Cosmic desktop, if you look at the repositories, everything is separated into a separate repository. Everything is a different piece of software, and you can combine that to create any user experience that you want. So the intent is just very similar to like our intent long-term with hardware platforms, is that anyone can take these components and the way they're designed and build unique experiences with them. And it's intended to be done that way. We're delivering a full desktop experience, but Cosmic can, it can be a photo frame, a gaming console, and it can be customized in a way. We're taking a lot of heavy lifting to be able to build this kind of experience and making that easy. And then you're taking these components and arranging them and writing some custom components to build your dream out of it.
And it's all written in Rust. To make it sexy to appeal to all the cool kids out there. But I guess you view Cosmic then more as a develop environment, I guess, and building blocks more so than a desktop environment.
Right. It's a platform for building user experiences.
Right.
Doesn't matter what that device or that screen, the screen is going on, might be. You can build user experiences with it. And for PopOS's purpose, it had to be really broad because we're building this for a full desktop experience.
Yeah.
And but you can take a smaller set of components or a larger set of components or precisely what we're doing. And just if you're a Linux distribution, for instance, you can rebrand it for your distribution, change the way the panels work, maybe modify applets that are in panels because that's better for your users, what you've identified as their needs, and build the perfect experience for your users all the way from the smallest device. And you think about Linux itself, why is Linux so successful? The kernel, that is. It's because it's so useful for a lot of people to build things with. We have all the components from audio subsystems to storage and memory and hardware drivers. And we have all the initialization and services of systemd. And we have all of these components. But what we didn't have was just that slice on top to build the user experience that they're seeing and interacting with on the screen. And that's the intent of Cosmic.
And you built it natively in Wayland, I believe?
It is Wayland native, yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of leapfrog the whole problem that much of the desktop world is suffering from in the Linux world, right?
Yeah, it has its own challenges.
Yeah.
Wayland, certainly at that point, when we started making the decision, reached the point where we didn't feel like our users would be losing a significant amount by not... We do have X Wayland for games, applications. It's just a support for a lot of things that are not Wayland native, but not a Wayland session. And so there were things that were outside of our control. The NVIDIA driver wasn't great when we started. Now we're 3 years in, and now I can say confidently that the NVIDIA experience on Wayland is now up to par with what it was on X11. So some things that were outside of our control, fortunately, filled in the gaps during our development too. So I think Wayland is, I think it's there. There are some gaps, but I think it's smaller and becoming maybe small nuisance things than just deal breakers.
Yeah, Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So I think when will we see Cosmic as a default desktop environment for Pop OS?
It'll be in the 2404 release. We're working on the beta now.
Okay.
We just got below where we did 7 alphas. And one of the things about a desktop environment in computers is that there's used in so many different ways that a long alpha period, I think, was really healthy for the project, because we have, I think there's probably tens of thousands of users on Cosmic now. So all of that feedback is helping with all those tiny little, this weird toolkit that the menus don't show up, or this other, exotic piece of hardware where the compositor needs some, special logic perhaps for that. Mm. All of those are, things that this cycle has helped solidify. And that's all the experience that Gnome had before, Katie had before. So now we're on the beta. I think we just got under 100 bugs, which the team size, it's not very big. So hopefully within a couple months. I keep missing my target, so I remiss that.
Do you think we'll go full circle and see Cosmic in Ubuntu as well?
That would be a dream, wouldn't it? I would love to see Cosmic be so good that it's irresistible for folks to ship to their users. So yeah, that's our dream.
Amazing. All right, I'm going to run through a few more questions before we wrap up today. But one of the questions that I'm curious about is, what was your most proud moment so far in the journey of System 76, either like a device shipped that you were really proud of, or like landing a customer that you're like, oh, wow, this is really cool?
It's probably open firmware. There are so many things that I'm proud of what our team has done. I'm building a factory. I can't pick one. We went from not knowing, we never built or ran a factory before, and we did it all organically internally. So that's really special. And then also cracking open firmware. So I have two. There you go. Trying to limit to that. But it's been a journey of really good successes, I think.
Interesting. And what kind of, outside of your tinkerer and your kind of regular Linux desktop user, what was the use case that you've seen that were like, oh wow, that's really cool, in probably like in some kind of non-local environment, I guess, non-desktop environment?
Right. We have we have desktops, we have servers and desktops running in Apache helicopters.
That's pretty cool.
Which I never had expected something like that. But apparently something like a 4 or 5-star general was in a helicopter while they were going over the tech they installed in it. And so it was System 76 hardware. So I thought that was pretty awesome. Also the GPL lab, Jet Propulsion Lab at NASA, uses a lot of hardware, and that's pretty special what they're doing with it. I think it was the Cassini project, when we sent a satellite to Saturn, where SimSix hardware was used, not on the satellite itself, but in designing and developing it. So that was awesome.
That's fun. We have actually a shared customer there. That's actually one of the Screenly customers as well. So
great.
They have very. So maybe we could get some System 76, the new hardware to them as well going forward. So that'll probably be a good synergy. Really cool. Good. Carl, this has been a pleasure. I think we've covered a lot of ground, and I really appreciate you coming on the show. Anything you want to do a shout out to before we wrap up? Things people should keep an eye out on, or things you want to just spread the word about in general?
Yeah, I think mostly I think your audience probably is very similar to our audience. I think let's all just keep fighting the good fight. Open source is the future, and it's all because of all the work we're doing each day.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Carl. I'm very much appreciated. Thank you so much. Have a good one. Cheers. Bye.